When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Apparently, a lot of people wondered how I got to keep my hair and be 230 pounds with 14% body fat and be relatively healthy while I did it. So I guess we'll tell you a lot of the secrets when we dig into this podcast, but there isn't really a particular secret that you can, you know, do one thing and have all of these results. And by these results, I mean have supposedly such good DEXA scan numbers and then still look like I have tiny arms. So listen more for some tips regarding that. Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast, where we give you tools to develop a balanced approach for health. I'm Dr. Kyle Gillette.
And I'm James O'Hara, nurse practitioner. And today we're doing a follow-up Q&A I guess relating to two videos. So First for our personal hair loss protocols, and then Number two for our personal anabolic protocols.
Yeah, so we really appreciate all the questions. There are several good questions, and we'll just kind of go through them line by line and do our best to answer, and we'll try to include timestamps as well. So you can skip around if there's just specific ones that you're interested in.
Yeah, so starting off, hey, Dr. Gillette, great episode. For maintaining fertility, do you recommend taking HCG from the beginning of TRT or waiting the 6 to 8 week phase to confirm via labs how one responds to something like testosterone alone?
Yeah, generally you don't want to start them the exact same time. Usually it takes a few months, depending on the individual, to start noticing testicular atrophy, or if you're in the case like me, if you already have testicular atrophy before anything, a lot of times you actually start with HCG, which is what I did a couple years ago, and then rehypertrophy the testes, and then consider other options from there. So I guess like anything else that you would chat with a specialist, the right answer is always, it depends. If you start testosterone and HCG at the same time, there is kind of a synergistic effect when it comes to acne. So that is a very common side effect. In general, you'd want to wait the 6 to 8 week phase, and not everybody needs to be on HCG all the time. As I mentioned in the podcast kind of leading up to this, most of the time I'm either on just HCG or just test SIP. So it depends. Hopefully that helps. Although a lot of people do testosterone and HCG at the same time.
Yeah. And context is always, it depends. So if someone is planning for fertility within the next year, you may be in a position where it's best to hold off on beginning testosterone in the first place.
Yep.
So lots to talk about with your clinician there.
Yeah, and get a sperm test before too. And bank your sperm as well, because why not?
Yeah, yep. Can't hurt.
Yep. Next question. What was your, and I'm not sure if they're talking about me or you, we could both answer it, I guess.
Yeah.
What was your optimized calculated free testosterone? Great question, because that is more accurate than the measured. Prior to starting replacement therapy, so actually prior to starting HCG, my optimized calculated free T, you know, I'm doing all the lifestyle management and taking my testosterone vitamin, because there's no such thing as a testosterone booster. I was taking my testosterone vitamin. I think it was something like 4 capsules of, I don't even know if we had Sigma back then. Anyway, it was something similar. And I think it was around 5 nanograms per deciliter. But my calculated free DHT, I wish I had checked a free DHT, I checked a free estradiol, was probably something like 6 or 7. I think it was still pretty high even on finasteride, because I was on finasteride before I was on HCG. I think finasteride was the first medication that I took.
For boosting
your T.
Or
maybe it was ezetimibe.
Actually, finasteride probably did boost your T slightly.
Yeah, if I was not on finasteride, my free T may have been... I think I got it up to 7, maybe 5 if I was not on finasteride.
Yeah. And I guess my optimized, I guess my peak free testosterone assuming a couple of things here. So if we go back over a decade, that makes me feel like I'm old.
You are like 50 or 60, I think.
I act like it. But if I go back to high school, I actually had some testosterone levels checked because I had broken a lot of bones growing up. And there was a question about bone density being an issue.
Smart guy.
It was partially myself, and then partially the doctor agreeing to check it. So a lot of places you would just be told, no, we're not going to check that. But I guess this is going back, there was a little bit of rapport between myself and my primary care provider.
Wow.
I was a younger guy that
as a
was
young
kind
male,
of that... known in the community yeah. and agreed to check a total testosterone level. No SHBG, no free T. I don't think I had gonadotropins because there wasn't really a need to do that. It was just kind of starting with, hey, what's the testosterone? And that level came back at 420-something. And assuming my SHBG has been similar, that probably puts my free testosterone between 10 and 11 nanograms per deciliter. So nothing necessarily wrong with that testosterone level. Prior to starting replacement therapy, my free testosterone level would have been closer to between 5 and 6 nanograms per deciliter. My total was between 230 and 250, two separate times. Mm-hmm. Now, this was the caveat while I was working night shift. Mm-hmm. One of those was a morning reading after a night sleep where I was actually sleeping at night on a day off. The other was a afternoon reading shortly after awakening on a night that I was going to be working. So I kind of checked both. At that time, I didn't know that the diurnal pulse was still mm-hmm. preserved. But in any case, by happenstance, got both readings. So assuming my SHBG was between 20 and 30, like it normally sits, that would put my free T between 5 and 6.
Yeah, and perhaps you did. I mean, in hindsight, that seems like a pretty good call. You haven't had any broken bones since. But yeah, I guess you could also make the argument, well, you should have quit your job, stopped working night shifts, stopped going to nursing school, stopped studying so hard late at night, and instead you should have went and done 3 hours of meditation and mindfulness for, dopaminergic tone and improved your sleep. Why didn't you do, and bought a sauna and
sun my testicles and, daily and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So why didn't you do that?
There are trade-offs. And the time being younger and focusing on working hours and income and advancing education, sort of having competing priorities, it seemed like the least bad option. As it relates, there's a lot of alternative things you can do for energy, and we can talk about those when I think someone asked about the TRT story. So
yeah,
we'll expand upon that a bit later.
Yeah,
that'd be a good one.
Yeah. And before we do that, I will say similar story with myself. What really did it for me, at least when I started the HGG at the start, is when I not only was delivering babies and not sleeping well and also trying to naturally optimize testosterone, I was also training quite hard, trying to get back into shape. And I also had 2 children under the age of 18 months. I had a newborn and an 18-month-old. So as you can imagine, as an involved father, I was not sleeping a lot between all those things.
That's pretty suboptimal for testosterone production.
Yep. Next is, I've heard you mention a few times about L-carnitine raising TMAO. It means, yes, you have gut microbiome dysbiosis, choline and carnitine are converted to TMAO in states of dysbiosis. This happened to this individual, it went up to over 60, and they've always had bloating issues. They've been taking the Seed probiotic. Seed probiotic's a probiotic that has, I believe, all the same strains as VSL number 3, which is Visbiome, plus a few extra. They also have good fiber intake, 5 to 6 servings fruit and vegetables. What else are they doing? So they are doing quite a bit.
Yeah. And the point about the L-carnitine raising TMAO, there's an interesting study that I shared about plant-based diets versus omnivorous diets and raising the TMAO. And it doesn't actually turn out to always be the case. I recently had a patient who was on a vegetarian diet and wanted to check TMAO levels. So we did because they were supplementing with L-carnitine. Mm-hmm. And they actually had elevated TMAO, so that doesn't seem to be a hard and fast rule. How big of a player is TMAO in the overall cardiovascular disease risk spectrum? Probably a relatively small one.
Yep.
But if you can make some changes, one thing this person didn't mention is perhaps supplementing with a berberine or some optimized garlic with allicin.
Yep.
Those are some things that have preclinical data that supports this change. Yep. Now, there are differences in rodents and humans, obviously, but anecdotally, this does seem to push down TMAO levels, or perhaps switching to a injectable form to bypass the GI tract altogether.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts there?
Yeah, probably until TMAO is under a bit better control, because 60 plus is pretty high. Decreasing the amount to some degree of L-carnitine or choline precursors. And that could include alpha GPC, that could include phosphatidylserine, which is in a lot of like calming supplements. Some multivitamins even have choline bitartrate, for example. So there's a lot of things that could be driving this up.
Yeah.
Carnivore diets, which this person's not on.
I would say congratulations to this person for having a good fiber intake and getting 5 to 6 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. That puts them in the like 1% of the population.
Yes. The things that this individual is doing to address the TMAO is going to have far better effects on health. Even if it does not budge the TMAO at all, the health is still significantly better for it than if they were just taking a supplement for it.
Absolutely.
Next, someone asked about, curious about total testosterone. They also have varicocele, about the same age as me, and low end of normal range free, so low normal free testosterone and total testosterone. So yeah, a lot of times with varicocele, and this was certainly the case in my case as well, although I did eat relatively low carb and did a lot of cardio, your SHBG runs on the higher end of normal. So it's more common to see a lower normal or a low free testosterone and a normal total testosterone, almost like andropause, or honestly kind of similar to people that have an orchiectomy or undescended testicle, testicle loss for whatever reason, traumatic loss, usually high SHBG, high FSH, low free T. And in general, you can estimate the severity or the grade of your varicocele based upon those markers. You're more likely to have a high grade or more atrophy with higher FSH, higher SHBG, and lower free T. Next, they're asking, presumably both of us, are we doing subcutaneous? And would love to know your hematocrit, hemoglobin, and estradiol levels, which I think you, in our previous podcast, you just posted some of those levels.
Yeah. So subcutaneous, yes. It seems like the sort of best way to go about it, you know, scar tissue in the muscle, potentially more stable blood levels. As far as the hematocrit, hemoglobin, personally, I've never had these levels high or even on the high end of the range. Mm. They tend to be about mid-range, which would be expected in my case. I'll talk a bit about that later. Estradiol levels tend to be just shy of a 1-to-2 conversion with my free testosterone. So.
Yep.
Assuming my free testosterone is something like 18, I would expect my estradiol level to be between 30 and 35. And that's a sensitive assay. The Roche-Eclia assay is going to push that number up a bit more.
Yep. Yeah, so if I check a sensitive estradiol, usually somewhere between 35 and 40, although if my free testosterone is something like 20, gets up to 25 nanograms per deciliter, then yeah, I would expect my estradiol to get up to 50, but honestly, it doesn't. Even on dutasteride and finasteride and HCG, my estradiol just does not run high.
Yeah, I will say I do tend to get a fair bit more aromatization versus testosterone production from something like an HCG. So I may only see a, you know, 80 nanogram per deciliter output in testosterone or adding that to my TRT, whereas the estradiol increase there could be something like 10, 15, 20 picograms per ml.
Yeah. Why are we calling dutasteride anabolic? It blocks conversion to DHT. Great question.
Yeah, maybe we can splice up the, were they, I think, siblings or identical? No, not identical twins, but perhaps twins that Derek had a conversation with someone about, showing the two that had the 5-alpha reductase deficiency had no hairline recession and more muscle mass.
Testosterone is arguably more anabolic than DHT, but much less androgenic. So dutasteride is for sure an anti-androgenic compound, but it is arguably mildly pro-anabolic. That's a great question.
this individual, I think, had commented on two separate videos with the same question.
Thank you for supporting the algorithm. Us via the algorithm. Yeah. Yes, we appreciate it. Next question regarding the Urology Times Journal. Real-world data for patients treated with 5-alpha reductase inhibitors showed sexual adverse effects occurred at higher rates in patients receiving finasteride compared with dutasteride. And that's probably taking into account the patients on dutasteride were on daily dutasteride, which is much stronger than finasteride.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you'd probably have to take 40 mg daily finasteride to be anywhere close. I'm partly just saying that because I think there is a study where someone took 40 mg dose of finasteride.
A loading dose.
Yep.
Actually, no, 400 finasteride.
Oh, wow.
40 was the loading dose of dutasteride, now that I think about it.
It's like a 3-year commitment to dutasteride. Anyways, according to the study in the European Association of Urology, the risk of ejaculation disorders was 8 times higher with finasteride than dutasteride. Risk of ED and decreased libido was 5 times higher. Clinicians should consider these data when prescribing 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, said Antonio Franco from Department of Urology in Rome. Very interesting comment. We've talked about kind of like the theoretical benefits of dutasteride for many hours on this podcast, but this, I guess, should not be particularly surprising.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I think I've seen this one, 2021. Mm-hmm. And it's mixed. Some will say that there's a similar rate of adverse events. Some will say, like this one, that it seems to be a lower risk of adverse events, specifically sexual function with dutasteride. And I think that there's an article specifically discussing post-finasteride syndrome.
Yep.
And that this has not been documented in dutasteride. Not to say that someone can't have signs of androgen deprivation from dutasteride, but it seems less common. And of course, there's differences in the number of prescriptions that are written also.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be interesting to see in the future as more meta-analyses come out that kind of pool all these data together.
What would a constantly high sex hormone binding globulin above 50 nanomole per liter and LH above 8 IU per liter, technically not high, but high normal, I get the point they're making there. What would these indicate despite normal testosterone levels, 650 to 800? FSH also on the low side, 2 to 3. And again, lots of times this is totally normal.
Yeah.
FSH. They've heard about testicular dysfunction and subclinical hypogonadism. Would love to know your thoughts. Subclinical hypogonadism.
Reminds me of subclinical hypothyroidism, which we now call the euthyroid 6 syndrome.
Is this a ICD-10 at this point in time?
It is not. Euthyroid 6 syndrome is, though. As far as this, my takeaway is LH receptor desensitivity, relative testicular dysfunction, eugonadal testicular dysfunction, and in general, Leydig cell dysfunction to some degree.
Yeah, so those are the moving parts there. Their free testosterone levels are probably on the lower end of normal, if not in a hypogonadal range, depending on how much above 50 the SHBG is. Things to increase the sensitivity to LH could make sense. Avoiding things that cause Leydig cell dysfunction, like chronic NSAID use, like even ibuprofen.
Iron overload.
Yeah, could cause some of these things.
Yep. Next question. My testosterone on dutasteride and 175 milligram per week, TRT, was 1,800. So total testosterone.
That sounds like some compounded testosterone.
Yeah,
it could have just from a certain compounding pharmacy.
It could have just been from certain compounding pharmacies that tend to be
overdosed.
I was going to say generously dosed, but generously dosed is actually just, never mind. So moving on, they're on 120 milligrams now because of how high the testosterone was. I'd be interested if they switched which compounding pharmacy or which carrier oil or whatnot the testosterone was. Have not gotten updated blood work yet. Estradiol was 36 nanograms per 36 nanograms per deciliter, probably picograms per mil.
Maybe that's the conversion. Is nanogram per deciliter the same as picogram per ml? Anyway, let's assume it's the standard
factor of 10 factor of 10 different. The sensitive assay estradiol was 36, probably picogram per mil. So I guess the question is this normal? Yes, it's normal. Dutasteride, especially if this person's on quite a bit of dutasteride, 175 milligrams of testosterone cypionate or enanthate per week will lead to, you know, probably 20% higher testosterone levels. It's not too surprising.
Yeah. And also sort of thinking, what is their protocol? Are they injecting this all once per week? Certainly a peak of 1800 wouldn't be surprising there. But if it is split up, or if you're checking a level, let's say 24 hours after one of your three weekly shots, something like that, if you do Monday, Wednesday, Friday, then that would be quite a bit higher than expected. But going down on the dose obviously makes sense here.
Yep. So it's a good question. And also in general, if your total testosterone level on dutasteride is, you know, say like 1200, 1300, that would be roughly equal to a, like, let's say your DHT is cut in half from 60 to 30 or 60 to 20 on finasteride or dutasteride. I would say 1200, 1300 total testosterone is still technically eugenol, physiologic range. You could even make an argument that 1200 or 1300, like, you know, there's plenty of people with naturally produced testosterone levels that high.
Yeah, it certainly can be a natural level, although relatively uncommon.
No, probably not if your SHBG is 7.
So speaking of endogenous T levels, someone asks, how high are both of your endogenous T levels? And just like we talked about, total range for myself has been somewhere between 230 and 420 something. Free testosterone between 5 and 11 nanogram per deciliter.
Yeah, and roughly the same for me. Probably a little bit lower free testosterone just because my SHBG runs quite high. And anytime you're talking about endogenous T levels, include what your SHBG is and include your DHT. DHT and SHBG both often over 60.
Oh, this is a good one. What does Kyle mean about being in a traffic jam wishing he was on dutasteride? This is because you were pulling your hair out in traffic, right?
Yeah, so I think I even typed up a pretty long response to this question on the last video via the Gillette Health account. But when you're on dutasteride, a lot of times you are less patient. So yeah, you kind of want to pull out your hair. Dutasteride, of course, affects the amount of DHT that's binding in the prefrontal cortex. Now, androgens don't necessarily cause aggression or rage. It can augment that effect. But as anybody will tell you, you know, generally, I'm walking around like I'm taking a daily Xanax and a daily cannabinoid, which is certainly not the case. I've been tested many times, and I do not take those things. But and no judgment to those that do, by the way. It's like, let's not get off on a rabbit trail here. But yeah, when I'm on dutasteride, it feels like there's slightly more patience.
And patience is a virtue.
Yeah. So again, total androgen pool. You know, if you're, you know, you put your tinfoil hat on and you think about the natural personality traits of every male and female, and if you're thinking about things like oral contraceptives or metabolic syndrome, which are causing lower total androgen pools, and also often more fluctuations, spikes and crashes is in androgens, it's not necessarily a good thing for society.
Yeah, that's a very deep and from a philosophical standpoint, that would be a fun conversation.
You want your calmest, kindest, most patient individuals to have high total androgen pools, and you want your most aggressive, meanest, immoral individuals to have low total androgen pools. There is a reason why we chemically castrate certain individuals that are guilty of horrible crimes.
So like a social credit score that shows you how high or how low your testosterone level can be.
If your social credit score is high, then you get 140 milligrams per week. If it's low, you get 20 milligrams per week. It's like, oh, I'm getting 20 milligrams per week. This is great. But really, it's just inhibiting natural production.
Yeah. But anyway, I guess speaking of tinfoil hats, creatine and hair loss scares me is our next comment. really not a reason to be scared of creatine as it relates to hair loss. I'd never say never that it couldn't possibly ever cause hair loss in somebody, because sometimes introducing new compounds into the body, your body can react. It could have a transient shedding phase, but it's certainly not going to overpower your finasteride or dutasteride, and it's probably not the major player in hair loss.
Yeah. Next question. James, are you available for individualized medicine in California?
Yes, I am licensed in California. It did take a long time because the California Board of Nursing is about as efficient as you would expect.
They're listening.
And if they're listening, I would appreciate improvement in customer service. And that's all I'll say.
Yeah, we do have a location opening up in Newport Beach here in a bit. My favorite canned sardine. My absolute favorite is Fishwife. I like their chili crisp, but that is a kind of prohibitively expensive for me to enjoy too often. Usually I'm eating the Wild Planet from Costco.
Yeah, I'll pick anything that's canned in oil just because it makes it more palatable, more enjoyable compared to being in water.
For sure. Would creatine help post-op rotator cuff surgery?
I would say yes. I would say that your ability to exercise, whether it's physical therapy, hopefully not CrossFit if you're post-rotator cuff surgery right away anyhow.
Not going to hurt.
But it's certainly going to improve your recovery from those PT sessions and your ability to go back and do more of those PT-specific prescribed exercises.
Yep. Going to help more if you have a low-protein diet. There's some supplements like Juven, which is kind of an amino acid vitamin blend that is particularly helpful in people with poor diets. Guys, fantastic video. James, hope you don't mind. What is your motivation? So you kind of talked about this already, but what is your motivation for starting TRT? You're young, although you look old. They didn't say that. You're young, probably had normal testosterone levels. Did you mainly aim for higher mental and physical energy, or do you expect longevity benefits? There are downsides, so taking such a step early in life requires higher conviction. Although they didn't say this either, arguably slightly less conviction if you have like a comfortable knowledge base about it. You guys are too smart to just be gym bros. Well, thank you. So what's your reason?
Yeah, so here is, entitled this James's TRT story. So like I talked about, I was working night shift and had checked some blood levels and they were low. And, 230, 250 nanogram per deciliter, somewhere in that range. And what I did, and by the way, I don't recommend this, but in the concept of transparency, I did testosterone as a test drive prior to getting a prescription for it to say, is this going to work? Have the benefits that I'm looking for? Not the smartest thing to do, but when you are, not blessed with a lot of resources at the time and trying to make things work and figure out, is this going to be a good investment? That was a choice that I chose to make. But then after I realized, hey, I am getting some benefits in terms of exercise recovery, there was certainly a component of that, but also just energy levels in general and motivation. I can't say that there was any difference in cognitive or mental function, although some people do report that. It's not something that I would say more than a quarter of people are specifically saying, hey, this got better after TRT. Certainly wasn't my case. So that's sort of my motivation behind it. So it's not 100% gym bro, not 100% for like mental performance, sort of looking at all of the potential benefits of it and then having an understanding about kind of how testosterone worked. Going back all the way to high school, I'd had levels checked at some point. I'd been reading about stuff since then, was in the medical field. So made it a little bit lower risk because I realized, hey, this isn't permanent. People don't, just because you go on some testosterone doesn't mean you're on it forever. And certainly I have considered now that I have a little bit more of an optimized lifestyle and sleep patterns, what would my natural levels be? But I also have the knowledge of my sensitivity to androgens with my CAG repeat length of 28. That actually puts me closer to Kennedy's disease than it does to the average repeat length for a Caucasian male. So being more on the androgen insensitive side, I don't see myself probably coming off of testosterone and even having a fall of my levels into like a low normal range. Again, I don't have proof that that would be harmful for me in the long term, but I like the idea of being able to recover from exercise, keep my lean body mass, improve my bone density, and then maintain a good degree of androgen signaling, also in the context of the other goal of keeping my hair.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's a bit of a background there.
It's a good example of individualized medicine where the patient's goals is one of the things to keep in account. You know, it's not a cookie cutter thing where everybody under the ages of 30 gets a SERM and everybody over the ages of 30 gets whatever testosterone regimen you happen to make the most money or get the most lunches for prescribing. So it's a good anecdote. Next question. Great podcast. Curious regarding both of our regimens. Have our dutasteride or finasteride protocols involved topical applications? Do we take tablets? Any concerns for finasteride syndrome?
So historically, I have used topical dutasteride. It was sort of a blend of dutasteride and minoxidil and some tretinoin. I didn't find it to be particularly effective. I do have a little bit more aggressive androgenic alopecia. My serum DHT level was 69 when I was taking that. So it was within the normal realm of conversion between at 5 and 10%. So in my case, I don't believe it was going systemic. But in some people, we do see evidence of that. And now my regimen is entirely oral in terms of the dutasteride and the finasteride, both of which I take orally.
Yeah. And as I've mentioned, with my regimen, I have not taken topicals. Not that I'm against topicals, but it's just the convenience of taking a tablet is fantastic. And on paper, I'm kind of a great candidate for dutasteride and finasteride. You know, very low estrogen, high progestogen pool, high strong androgens, high DHT, low anxiousness, OCD type predispositions, naturally pretty high libido. So in fact, I was kind of hoping that in the pelvic rest period after having my second kid, that it would kind of help if I increase the dose. That's when I tried daily finasteride, daily dutasteride, and 3 times a day salt palmetto. I really didn't see huge beneficial effects of decreasing that during that period of time. Partly just because I knew I was a great candidate on paper. So that's what I did. Yeah, currently I take dutasteride. Only comes in 0.5 mg capsules. Don't recommend the compounded. I take that orally twice a week.
Yeah, it's a great overview. Another one says, I guess this is in relation to things that are anabolic. Does tricosterone or ectosteroids compete or counter using Tomcat and Fidoja at the same time? Could all three be utilized at once, or do their mechanisms of action counter one another to some degree? This is a thoughtful question because you certainly wouldn't want to be, first acknowledging that supplements have interactions potentially is a great step, and you wouldn't want to be countering benefits of something with something else.
Yeah. So instead of just saying, ectosteroids or Tomcat or Fidoja is trash or it's amazing, everyone should take it. You should realize that supplements have pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics too. What is the mechanism of action? What is the effect on the body? And I would say these do potentially interact, not significantly, and the mechanisms of action do not interact. But given that tricosterone and beta-ectosterone, the two main ectosteroids, first of all, if they're not bioavailable, then they're not going to be binding the beta-estrogenyl receptor.
So then they don't need to be have pharmacokinetics. If they're not bioavailable.
They still do, but you would have to inject them, which I don't recommend doing that. Don't even think about that. Forget about that. That I know of, the only complex makes these things easier to absorb. Ectosteroids that I know of are the Gorillamine / Intelligent ectosteroids. In general, these are really only applicable for people that have rock bottom estradiols. Mostly postmenopausal females with low estradiol, so lean, low body fat postmenopausal females, or females with breast cancer on aromatase inhibitors that have extremely low estrogen. Past that, perhaps if there's like a really lean male that has a sensitive estradiol less than like 2 or 3.
So like, thinking of like a marathoner or an endurance athlete, that sort of phenotype.
Yeah, or perhaps like a Olympic weightlifter or a power lifter that you know, is either a postmenopausal female or a male that has relatively low free testosterone. They're cutting down to make a weight class. And they check a sensitive estradiol and it's like less than 2.5. Then, yeah, they probably get some fluid retention and perhaps some anabolic benefit from those. Tonkat Vidoja, we've done many podcasts on. And yeah, they have niche applications for natural optimization where the benefit outweighs the potential risk. But in general, I can't see any scenario where you'd want to utilize all three.
Yeah, if you're using, let's put this directionally, if you're using Tonkat and Vidoja, the estradiol itself that goes up is probably going to be a more potent lever than using the beta-ectosterone or tricosterone, even if it's complex.
Yep. Thoughts on compounded test cream, or presumably androgel test gel as well? It seems that ester-free testosterone has benefits, less suppression potentially, and DHT benefits.
Benefits of DHT.
Yeah. I suppose if there's a reason why you're trying to dose really low, but then still, honestly, I think there's more of a DHT detriment because the 5-alpha reduction and conversion of testosterone to DHT you get via transdermal application, whether it is the patch, the cream, or gel, is supraphysiologic. So you do see more erythrocytosis and theoretically more blood clots. And more left ventricular hypertrophy. So yeah, I would say that's one of the reasons why we don't prefer compounded test cream. In general, if people have significant needle phobia, better options are Natesto, which is nasal testosterone, and lymphatically absorbed testosterone, like Jotenzo.
Yeah, an oral lymphatically absorbed testosterone would make a lot more sense in this scenario from a risk-benefit standpoint. Although there can be sort of a niche scenario where test cream is used intermittently for an acute sort of libido boost if somebody does seem to benefit a little bit from a hormone fluctuation. Generally, we would think more stability is better, but some people probably need a little bit of up and down sort of to mimic the diurnal pattern. So, you know, use a test cream once per week maybe to help libido would be sort of the one-off scenario where I could think, okay, that might make sense in some people.
Yep. Next question. This person would love to hear our thoughts on varicoceles. If 30% of men have some grade of varicocele, yet almost nobody talks about it. That's true. Most of this 30% is individuals who have relatively low grade. That's not likely to affect their, chance at fertility, but it does affect their sperm count, and it is likely to affect their testosterone to some degree. And it can make them more prone to things like heat damage to the testicle.
Yeah, and you and I have talked a bit about this in like a varicocele repair or varicocelectomy. Mm-hmm. And there is data supporting like, hey, if you get your varicocele repaired, that you get some improvement in testosterone, 100, 200, maybe 300 nanogram per deciliter, depending. Mm-hmm. It may not be a durable effect, but in the short term, it does improve that. If there's significant testicular pain, there can be a reason to do so.
Yep.
I think the reason less people talk about it is because there's not a reimbursement model where a urologist will perform this procedure and get reimbursed just because you want to take your testosterone level from 500 to 800 nanogram per deciliter. So yes, the varicocele is there. It's lowering the testosterone. It's lowering sperm count, but it's not what they would call clinically significant. So I think that's the reason that it's not more talked about.
Yeah. I remember going to a urologist even within the past couple of years, and I've since found a urologist who actually we should have on the podcast, who's fantastic. But I remember going to one and saying, you know, I've had some things done, but I'm having a lot of testicular pain, you know, on HCG, which I do for hypertrophy. My varicocele pain's worse. My hemorrhoids are worse. My acne's worse. What about getting this ligated versus embolized? Which generally an IR would embolize it. A urologist would ligate it, but it's much more expensive to embolize. And basically the only thing that was said was, well, are you infertile? Do you have kids? I was like, well, I have a couple kids. Not infertile, but I also know, you know, ways to improve my fertility. And they were like, well, why would you want to do that? And I was like, is this person serious? Like, do they know the association about testosterone and, you know, earlier testicular failure, earlier andropause, et cetera, et cetera. Even more hemosiderin deposits because you have more venous stasis. Mm-hmm. And yeah, most people just don't know this. So we will dedicate an entire podcast to this. And now that I think of it, I will ask that top-notch urologist to come on.
Yeah, I think that'd be great info. So no one is talking about it, then why not us? Let's talk about it. Next, does L-carnitine overall negatively impact hair loss? It increases androgen receptor density, but it also helps shuttle fatty acids into mitochondria, which decreases apoptosis in follicular cells,
Great question. Yeah. And they answer the question too. So we agree, likely a net neutral.
Yeah, we don't know. And again, we would think it probably would increase AR content in the skin as well, scalp skin, but I don't think we have any data to point to. But I don't think that there's been a marked association of people taking L-carnitine supplements or injecting L-carnitine and having hair loss follow. So it probably is a net neutral, which theoretically makes sense.
Yep. Next question. Hi, could you please talk about possibility, or if presumably if they should, use a product like Gorilla Mind Sigma, which has Tongkat Ali, Fidoja Agrestis, to potentially increase net androgens before and during intake of oral finasteride or dutasteride? Any dangerous or counteractions between these natural test boosters and 5-alpha reductase inhibitors? Interesting. I know we've talked about a lot of the potential adverse effects and things to monitor for these supplements, but I don't think we've talked about the interaction between the two. Could you accompany that with the explanation of mechanism of action again, presumably of the proposed mechanism of action of Fidoja agrestis and Tongkat Ali? And then, and they asked, is it the increased LH that stimulates Leydig cells in the testes for Fidoja? Yes.
Yeah, so you're going to see an increase in testosterone numbers just from the 5-AR inhibitor alone. The Tongkat Ali, we have more data in terms of what you could expect from that. And some people will be non-responders, but some people do get a very robust response to Tongkat Ali. The mechanism there is basically upregulating certain enzymes for steroidogenesis. And this is primarily happening in the Leydig cells, some in the adrenal cells. Mm-hmm. You're going to get a bit more of a net increase in DHEA production. And also an increase in steroids that upstream lead to the testosterone downstream produced by the Leydig cells.
Yep.
On the Fidoja side, primarily we're thinking in simple terms, like you'll get more net LH signaling at the level of the Leydig cell, mm-hmm. perhaps an increase in serum LH as well. So mm-hmm. all of those pieces together, if you're looking for what are the possible side effects here, basically the side effects would be related to if you have too large of an increase in testosterone, then you could, in theory, have the same effects as taking too much testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's less likely because usually you're not going to be capable of a natural production of something like 1,500 nanogram per deciliter. And then, you know, pair that with being on finasteride, dutasteride, a little bit more likely to have some nipple sensitivity, symptoms of high estrogen, those sorts of things.
Yeah, Tongkat does not appear to be a clinically significant aromatase inhibitor. Again, in human studies, estradiol levels tend to increase congruently with androgen levels, and SHBG can increase if it's extremely low, presumably because of increased estrogen. And it does tend to decrease if it's extremely high, usually over 100. It's not unusual for Tongkat to help decrease that, especially in females, possibly because of androgen levels. But one thing that we should note, and I know we've done podcasts on this several times before, so we won't belabor it, is the safest way to avoid genotoxicity is to let your testes atrophy and make sure that there's very low enzymatic activity that could be producing any sort of androgen or hormone, because even just high natural endogenous levels could carry that risk. So I kind of say that, you know, tongue in cheek, because lots of things carry genotoxic risk. And a lot of times that there's studies from various parties that are promoting other things in the testosterone booster world. There's a whole bunch of parties that are very financially involved. I believe we have, I would say, essentially, for all intents and purposes, zero significant financial involvement within promoting
Whether it's a stinging nettle root extract, or whether it's bulbine, or whether it's substanti, or whether it's fidosia, or whether it's tongkat. Really zero skin in the game. We just see what works, and we monitor for side effects for our patients that do take these things, just like we would for medications. Your bare bone stack is still selenium, boron, vitamin D, and zinc.
Magnesium.
Yep. Making sure you have those things either in the diet or via supplementation.
Yeah. And someone please do study fidosia, because as of the time of recording, there are still zero studies published in humans on fidosia.
Yep. So specifically fidosia agrestis, there's other species in the fidosia genus, which have very concerning data, which are really not worth doing clinical studies, not really worth doing a human study. So that's the species that we're most interested in.
All right. Now, Juicebox 86 says, blood work in, fellows. After 4 months of less than 70 grams of carbs per day, I am finally back in range for my fasting blood glucose at 99 milligrams per deciliter. Currently, yeah, top side of normal, but better than it was. AST, probably ALT, back in range. BUN, BUN creatinine ratio are both still on the upper end. Not sure if this is creatinine supplementation, probably, or extra protein.
Probably.
Also been increasing meat intake, so maybe that's that. I said, not sure what to do other than drink more water. I think we have a great answer for this as it relates to kidney function.
Yep.
Check a cystatin C. That's going to give you a much more accurate marker of kidney function if you are increasing lean body mass or resistance training. The BUN could be elevated from increased protein intake. You have a series of conversions from amino acids into ammonium, into urea, that will drive up your BUN sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then the creatinine increases as body mass, specifically lean body mass, increase.
Yep.
So we can't really say whether or not it's concerning just based on this limited information. But if this is all I had to go off of, I would say check a cystatin C and congratulations on lowering the glucose.
Yeah, this is great. Maybe consider a CGM as well, given that 99 is still a touch on the higher end. Mm. Maybe also look at a fasting insulin. Probably no reason to jump to an AMDA, SMDA, although a lot of health optimization clinics would probably throw that on the panel. Just start a cystatin C first. You can also calculate an eGFR from your cystatin C and then bring that into your primary doc or even your nephrologist, and they will thank you for getting an accurate eGFR, and you don't have to stop your creatinine, or your creatine. If you're taking creatinine, then maybe you can stop that.
Yeah. Now we have someone saying, in response to our anabolics video, presumably, mm-hmm. was wondering how I can get those 12 and a half inch guns, presumably in reference to our arm circumference, or maybe arm diameter.
12 and a half inch guns. I was going to say, the only thing that I have that's 12 and a half inches is my calves. And I can give you some tips on getting those and all the exercises I do for that. But yeah, I suppose what would the influencer answer be to that? See my deadlift, see my bench.
Are and we here's going to my, post our
my
stats?
DEXA scan. Yeah, yeah, let's post my DEXA scan up. Cameron can put it on there. And then if you can beat that, like lean body mass to body fat ratio or whatnot.
Actually, you did. Yeah, I think you put your DEXA up on Instagram
story
the other day.
Yeah. So we'll post that up for an influencer answer.
There you go.
Little angry face. Hi, I have been on finasteride for 1 year now and have halted my hair loss with slight regrowth. I have experienced no major side effects, but slightly less morning erections and slightly less libido. Would it be reasonable to switch from 1 milligram finasteride daily to 0.5 mg dutasteride once a week and see how they respond?
I assume they mean 0.5 dutasteride. They actually don't specify the medication there.
True. I added that part.
Yeah.
It's got
to
be that.
Could even be reasonable to switch to 0.25 milligram of finasteride daily. You get about the same level of DHT suppression. But if they're looking to continue this pattern of regrowth, probably a better chance with sort of dipping their toe in the water of the dutasteride side of things.
Probably so. It is slightly tempting, as with anything else. We'd ask where the lab's at and then where are those various markers. Progestogen pool, androgen to estrogen ratio, total estrogens, and then OCD, libido, anxiety tendencies.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think 0.5 milligrams every 5 days would be about on par with 1 milligram of finasteride, just based on the data that's out there. But certainly would want to start a little bit slower and then titrate up as tolerated.
Mm-hmm. Next question. Can you talk about proviron? I wonder if this is like Cameron or my brothers or someone asking these various questions about our guns and proviron. But thank you. We love talking about any synthetic androgen. But yeah, commonly used in Europe. Non-suppressive, right? And can be used to lower SHBG with no side effects.
And it can lower
Lp(a).
It can lower total testosterone too. Oh, we're talking about advantages of, or the upsides of proviron. Yeah, as you mentioned, used in European countries, not approved here in the United States. Mm-hmm. It certainly can be suppressive at high enough doses. And if you're lowering your SHBG, which can lower SHBG very potently, then you are also going to burn through your total testosterone very quickly, lowering your total testosterone, even if you are not suppressed.
It's a synthetic androgen, DHT derivative. So the dose makes the poison. If there is clinical utility, and I don't think there's any studies, there's studies on its cousin, oxandrolone, on lipoprotein(a). But if there's clinical utility, that would probably be it. And extremely small doses. But yeah, assuming that they're talking about oral proviron, any oral androgen going through first pass in the liver, the downside is almost for sure going to outweigh the upside.
Yeah, and if I was sort of just picking a drug to run a trial on LPA outcomes, I would pick something less liver toxic. I would go with
oxandrolone.
Unless pelacarsen happens to have a side effect of increasing lean body mass, you never know.
That's true. But yeah, we'll do a lot more on Lp(a) in the future. It looks like that is the last question.
I guess that's a wrap.
Yeah. Thank you everyone for sending the questions. Keep sending more and we'll keep doing Q&A podcast. But yeah, thank you for your time and stimulating the algorithm. And as always, may God bless you with health and happiness.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.